I'm going to start recording now. Start recording now. Welcome, everybody.
Welcome, everybody.
This is the second lecture, in our course on women in Indian Buddhism. And it is my great pleasure today to welcome Amy Langenberg, who will speak to us on female agency in two Sanskrit Vinayas. Amy Langenberg is an assistant professor of religious studies at Eckhart College. This is a liberal arts college in St. Petersburg, Florida. She did a PhD in religion from Columbia University, with a special focus on Indian Buddhism. Her research interests include the early history of the Nan Sangha, Indian Buddhist representation, and discussions of the female body, and contemporary Buddhist feminism. She has published articles on, among other things, Indian Buddhist fertility practices and female healers in the Vinaya traditions. She has recently completed a book manuscript entitled Birth in Buddhism, Fertility, the Fetus, and the Female in Indian Buddhist Texts from the Middle Period. Enough from my side, and we all look forward to Amy Langenberg.
Okay, so so I changed the title of my talk a little bit from Female Virtue in Two Sanskrit Vinayas to Female Agency in Two Sanskrit Vinayas, and I think that reflects what I want to focus on today a little better than my original title. So I'm going to start with giving you a little background on the two texts that I'm going to be discussing today or drawing from today. The first one is the Mahasanghika Lokottaravadin Bhikshuni Vinaya, which I'm going to, from henceforth, just call the Malok Bhikshuni Vinaya because the full title is kind of a mouthful and I think my tongue will get tired, so I think I'm just going to shorten it to that. So we have one edition of this text, one edited version of this text, which is by Gustav Roth. And it's based on a single manuscript, which he brought from Tibet to India. It's an 11th or 12th century manuscript. Rahula Sankratyayana brought it to India from Tibet in the 1930s, and then Roth edited it. So my discussion of the text is based on the Roth edition. We have also some other texts from related traditions. So we have the Mahasanghika Vinaya, which was brought to China by the pilgrim Fashen and translated into Chinese in the 5th century. And we have an English translation of this by Akira Hirakawa. So we have that resource. And also there are some various shorter Sanskrit manuscripts or fragments from this tradition, both the Mahasanghika Lokottaravadin tradition and the Mahasanghika tradition. And of course, we also have the Mahavastu, which is associated with the Mahasanghika Lokottaravada. Oh, and I meant to mention that I think that I will probably go through everything I have to say, and then afterwards you can ask some questions in the chat box. I think we'll do it that way. So this Bhikshuni Vinaya is one of two complete Vinaya traditions which are extant in Indic languages, the other being the Pali tradition. And it has some interesting, remarkable features, which I think is useful for you to know about. So first of all, the text places the tale of the Nan Sangha's founding and the Buddha's passing down of the 8 Guru Dharmas at the beginning, before the Bhikshuni Pratimoksha Vibhanga, right, which is the commentary and the basic legal code for nuns. And this arrangement is really different from that of the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya or the Pali Vinaya. It's actually even different from the Mahasanghika Vinaya. all of which bury the story in the Skandaka section of the text, which comes after the Vibhanga. So this text, what that means is the significance of that is that this text is compact, but it's a complete Vinaya text, which includes both the 8 Guru Dharmas and the Pratimoksha commentary, plus some other minor rules. And it orders itself in a way that is coherent and easy for the nuns to use. This is why I sometimes call this text a nun-centric text. Another interesting aspect of this Vinaya text is the fact that unlike in the Mular Savasivada Vinaya tradition, Mahaprajapati consults directly with the Buddha when a problem arises, rather than sending a message via the monks. So this text specifically depicts an open line of communication between the nuns themselves and the source of the legal tradition, the Buddha. So this is another aspect of what I call its nun-centric nature. Okay, so that's the one text. The other text I'm going to look at, although draw from a little less heavily, is the Mular Savastivada Vinaya, which is a Sanskrit Vinaya, which most scholars now date to the first few centuries of the first millennium. It's a massive text. It's 8,000 folial pages in Tibetan translation, and includes, in addition to a complete monastic code, a very rich story literature, sutra discourses, ritual texts. So it has a lot of added material. Large portions of the Vinayavastu section of this Vinaya survive in Sanskrit. They were unearthed in Gilgit in the 1930s. And the entire text exists in Tibetan translation as the first part of the Tibetan Khandra collection. It was also translated into Chinese by I Ching in the 7th century, but the Chinese translation is summarized apparently in shortened in sections, so it's not quite as full and complete as the Tibetan translation. Unfortunately, the Bhikshuni, Vibhanga, and Skandaka portions of the text are not among the sections preserved in Sanskrit at Gilgit. There does exist a Sanskrit fragment of the passage recounting the foundation of the nun's order, but most of the texts that I'm going to talk about today are translated from Tibetan, not from the Sanskrit. So I just wanted to say a word about the Sanskrit medium of these texts. So I even put that in my title. And I think it is significant that both of these texts are Sanskrit. Of course, the Malok Bhikshuni Vinaya is in a Sanskrit that is not standard, so some would refer to its language as Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit. But I think that the Sanskrit language of these texts is significant in terms of the cultural context, the social context in which they were produced. I'm not going to really focus on that today, but I think it's worth noting. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit before we look at specific passages. I want to talk a little bit about how scholars have approached Vinaya texts in the past and how we might approach them in order to learn more about women in early Indian Buddhism. At first, Indologists approached Vinaya texts mostly as a source of evidence of the earliest community, the community surrounding or coming just after the Buddha's time. So Erich Fraubaner is an important example of this type of approach. In his 1956 monograph, which is called The Earliest Vinaya and the Beginnings of Buddhist Literature, he compared the content of all the extant Vinayas in the hopes of getting at an original text, which he refers to as the, quote, Old Skandaka. And he actually describes this as he believes this was the first great literary work of Buddhism. He was motivated in this, in part at least, by the desire to get back to Buddhist origins, to get a glimpse of the earliest Buddhist community surrounding the Buddha. In order to do this, earlier layers of the tradition had to be separated from the later layers. The earlier layers could be presumed to represent more closely the situation of the early community. For Falvanner, what he called the old Skandika represented the earliest historical layer of the Vinaya literature, and maybe all Buddhist literature. So that's Falvanner. The French Buddhologist Etienne Lamotte was a critic of Falvanner's theory, believing difference between Vinaya texts to be evidence of an early rather than a late date, as he presumed that a homogenizing or regularizing process would result over time in greater uniformity in the various traditions. Regardless of such differences, both of these last century scholars are similar in that they approach Vinaya texts for what they could allegedly tell us about the earliest community. So the next interpretive approach that's important to look at is that of Gregory Chopin, who has little, I don't think, much interest in the quest sort of for Buddhist origins, but he's very similar to Falvanner and Lamotte in that his approach to Vinaya texts is primarily historical. As is well known, I think, probably to most of you, Chopin is an expert in the Müller-Sebastiavada Vinaya tradition, although his work is comparative and he does certainly draw on other Vinaya traditions. His special contribution is his use of the Vinaya text alongside inscriptions and other physical evidence. His writings describe a mature, pragmatic, rather worldly Buddhist monasticism, which was very well integrated into the financial, social, and political life of ancient North India. So he is describing a worldly sangha that's quite different from the sort of ethereal group set apart from the world, bent on some kind of transcendence, which earlier scholars had tended to characterize the Buddhist community as. Despite their differences, Chopin, however, I think is very much like Falvanner and Lamotte, in the sense that he assumes a more or less direct correspondence between the world of the MSV, the text of the MSV, and the actual world of ancient Buddhist North India. So he doesn't treat the relationship between text and world with very much doubt, hermeneutical doubt, you could say, or circumcision. That's not the right word. Circumspection, excuse me. And downplays the literariness and textuality, as well as the normativity of the Müller-Sebastiavada Vinaya. Okay, so that's Chopin. So here's one more approach I think that it's useful for us to look at as we think about how to approach these texts. So in her very wonderful, excellent 2009 dissertation on ethics and gender in the Müller-Sebastiavada Vinaya, Diana Domchow-Finnegan is quite critical of Chopin's approach, which really has dominated Vinaya studies for several decades now. Finnegan feels that to view Vinaya narratives as what she calls, quote, mimetic descriptions of actual historical practices, unquote, is mistaken. For one thing, she wonders about how one can justify using a piece of evidence like the Müller-Sebastiavada Vinaya that belongs to no single period as a historical document. And she also raises the possibility that the accounts or practices or happenings described in the Vinaya might be purely discursive constructs, expressive of the concerns and preoccupations of the Vinaya authors, but not reflective of some kind of historical social reality. So I'm gonna just show you a place in her dissertation where she makes this point. Excuse me, I have the slides in the wrong order. Let's go one more. Okay. So she writes, when the MSV recounts tales of unusual funeral or money-lending practices or stories about the mischievous deeds of naughty monks, these might indicate such activity in the monastic communities when the MSV was finally redacted or during one of its earlier layers of composition and agglutination. But then again, they might not. It might simply mean they, meaning the authors of the text, we're able to imagine such practices. Alternatively, it might reflect the narrator's wish that their readers believe that the early Sangha was rather badly behaved, perhaps so that the misdeeds of the narrator's contemporary monks might seem less egregious. Or, quite possibly, the narrators feared that the monastics might one day engage in such activities and fictitiously depicted such acts preemptively in order to prohibit them. Or perhaps what we see at any given moment arises from the obviously fertile imaginations of the consummate storytellers whose art dazzles us as we read the MSV. Okay, so Finnegan argues that Vinaya is better read as a literary text than as an historical document, or maybe even as a legal code. In particular, she is interested in representations of women in the text, representations that both offer possibilities to and simultaneously set boundaries for monastic women. So she is following a classic feminist interpretive path when she writes, any reading that does not take into consideration the politics of representation is bound to be simply subjected to the authority of those representations. Okay, so she's interested in the representation of the female in these texts and the way that these representations represent a certain gendered worldview. And she takes the literary nature of the text very seriously. Okay, so these are some of the approaches that I see out there in the literature. And now I want to talk a little bit about how I approach the text, how I think I want to approach the text. I locate my approach somewhere in the middle region between the harder historicism of Chopin and the literary approach of Finnegan. So I agree completely with Finnegan that it is crucial to recognize the literary and storytelling quality of the Vinaya texts. And also its, as she calls them, it politics of representation. So obviously Vinaya texts are not transparent descriptions of Buddhist life in ancient India. Any more than, say, a Hollywood film is a direct and mural-like representation of American life. Nonetheless, as much as I agree with Finnegan's insistence that the literary nature of Vinaya texts, especially the highly prolix MSV, be taken very seriously, I would still argue that Vinaya stories probably do convey information that could be called historical. And here I'm thinking particularly of the framing narratives that set the stage for the passing down of each Vinaya rule, not so much the Avadana type story material that is such a prominent feature of the MSV in particular. So these framing stories that set the kind of stage for the rules that tell the context of the passing down of the rules, they often are comedic or farcical, and they're sometimes dramatic or inspiring, but we can't sort of compare them to science fiction or fantasy, right? In some sense, they reflect something, I believe, about the socio-historical reality of the period in which they were composed. So another aspect of Vinayas, which I think is really interesting, is that these texts contain entire legal codes. The legal dimension of Vinaya texts poses interesting questions for the historically inclined scholar. The existence of a law that was theoretically enforceable by means of a clearly defined legal procedure seems to suggest, I would say, a way to connect text to world in a more or less direct manner. If monks and nuns were supposed to behave in certain prescribed ways in order to remain in good standing in the community, it seems like you can assume that some of them did so at least some of the time. And on the flip side, if a behavior is prescribed, is forbidden, it seems fair to assume that perhaps a certain number of monks or nuns may have engaged in that behavior. So the legal nature, the fact that these are rules for living, seem to suggest some way of connecting the text to the historical worlds. Now, having said that, Vinaya is subject to some of the same ambiguities as another South Asian legal tradition that's contemporaneous with Buddhist Vinaya, which is the Brahmanic Dharma Shastra tradition. So one can ask, and it often is asked, are legal texts such as the Dharma Shastra and perhaps the Vinaya, should we take them as purely normative texts, ideals, and therefore several steps removed from social reality? Or can they be taken as descriptive of ancient Brahmin or Buddhist community life? Another related question is, can we call these codes positive law in the sense that they contain laws that were enforceable, that were enforced by some sort of authoritative body, or were used to settle disputes? Or is it better to think of these traditions passed down by ancient lawgivers as natural or moral law, so a kind of ethical ideal, but they can't necessarily be connected to any real historical reality? So it seems to me that from my reading that scholars of Brahmanic legal literature have considered some of these broad interpretive questions about the underlying nature of ancient legal traditions and how we should approach them as scholars, as interpreters of them, a little more probingly or critically than scholars of Buddhist Vinaya have as of yet. So I think perhaps that they can help us out a little bit in figuring out or thinking about how to approach the reading of Vinaya texts. Richard LaRiviere, who has written on Dharma Shastra, argues strongly that while Dharma Shastra texts participate in a fiction about themselves regarding their Vedic and therefore timeless origins, in fact, they should be thought of as records of custom, what he calls records of custom. In other words, they record the way of life of actual people living in various regions of ancient India at the time. So LaRiviere believes, he thinks that the Dharma Shastra texts actually describe themselves this way, as they describe themselves often as records of, quote, what honorable men praise. Now, as LaRiviere knows well, as records of custom, or even if they are records of custom, Dharma Shastra texts are not always straightforward or transparent because they participate in this Vedic idiom, as he calls it. And I want to show you, I want to go back to the last slide and look at something he says about this. So let's look at the slide. He says that the Dharma literature is a record of custom is obfuscated by the fact that the idiom of all the Dharma literature is one of eternality and timelessness. This means that there are no contemporaneous references which can help us to establish the chronology of these ideas, nor is there admission that custom and practice changed and evolved over time. It is further obfuscated by the fact that the Dharma literature clings to the claim that all of its provisions can be traced directly or indirectly to the Veda, the very root of Dharma. Okay, so there is rationalization and accommodation of custom, accommodation to normative Brahmin religious ideals and social norms. I think that LaRiviere's take on Dharma Shastra literature is quite helpful for thinking about how to read Vinaya literature. Might it make sense to look at Buddhist Vinaya similarly as a record of monastic custom that has been, and these are LaRiviere's adjectives, not necessarily mine, doctored, sanitized, or accommodated to Buddhist doctrines and sensibilities? It seems to me obviously more sensible and intellectually defensible to view my two texts, which must have been compiled over a period of centuries, as evidence of a living, breathing, communal monastic life that developed over several generations, than as inspired laws passed down over the course of one extraordinary lifetime by a lawgiver. LaRiviere says that in the case of Dharma Shastra texts, the commentators often meet with practices of which they don't approve, but must somehow attempt to accommodate to their Brahminic moral and religious perspectives. Perhaps we see something of a similar process, for instance, in the casuistry associated with individual Vinaya rules. The strict and pure rule, the one most easily reconciled with the principles laid out in the Buddhist teachings, comes first, followed by the various accommodations to pragmatic reality. Using Le Riviere's approach, these various accommodations could be taken to reflect the customary behavior and communal wisdom of monastics as they actually lived in community. So I'm going to give you an example of what I mean. This is from Guru Dharma 4 of the Malu Bhikshuni Vinaya. And of course, the Guru Dharmas are the 8 rules to be respected that were said to have been laid down by the Buddha for all nuns at the time of the founding of the Nun Sangha. And I think it's interesting to note also that this particular Guru Dharma is apparently unique to this particular Vinaya tradition, is not found in the other traditions. So the rule is, the normative rule is, offerings should go to the monks' community first, and then the nuns' community, which is a formal ritual recognition of the proper structure of the Sangha, the hierarchical gender structure of the Sangha. The way this rule is then interpreted shows that in practice, however, it was possible to formally follow this rule without materially limiting or restricting the nuns' community. So let's take a look at the text. And this is, again, this is excerpted. It's a much longer discussion of this rule. So now, how is it Gautami that the nuns' community must not avail themselves of first-time offerings of food, beds, and seats and housing before the assembly of monks do? Someone who makes a food offering to the nuns' community should be told, you must do it following the most excellent procedure. Then if he says, there is no faith in that for me, no grace, he is to be told, as for us, the nuns, we do not accept this offering. Now he says, my mother, my father, a member of my men's organization, a professional associate, one of my friends, have all previously given a food offering to them, but I myself have never previously made an offering to the noble ones. Let the noble ones receive a food offering. If, in this way, the assembly of nuns causes even as much as one bowl of rice to be offered to the assembly of monks, then, should it accept even 100 flavor food, this does not constitute a fault. I'm reading what Bhikkhu Anālayo has to say. And he says that it indeed is unique to the Mahasanghika. Thank you. Okay. So what we have here is that as long as some offering is made to the monks' community, even a single bowl of rice, nuns could feel free to accept the generous and fine offerings of their supporters without worry of transgressing even 100 flavor food, right? So this is, an example of perhaps the strict and pure rule of the monk's priority being followed, while the sort of adjustments to the rule reflect the practical accommodations that may have been made. Okay. So inspired by Le Riviere's reading of Dharmashastra texts, by Chopin's historical mining of these texts for historical details, and by Finnegan's literary approach, I am proposing then what I'm calling a trimodal reading of the 2 Vinaya traditions we are considering today. In other words, I think we should read these texts in a flexible manner, using several interpretive approaches depending on the specific passage in question. So the 3 interpretive approaches would be the following. So the first would be, as Finnegan wants us to do, reading the text as literary products of a certain particular gendered worldview, not always, not naively as transparent mirrors of events. Okay, that would be the first. The second text, the second interpretive mode would be reading the text as normative statements about ethical ideals, which are connected to core Buddhist teachings or rituals formative of and foundational to Buddhist community life. So principles like brahmacharya, right, or ahimsa, no non-harm. Okay, so that would be the second approach. The third approach would be reading, as La Riviere says we might, reading the text as records of custom or records of the complex monastic life of Buddhist communities as they developed over time. And I would like to add, to emphasize that it may be that many portions must be read in two or all three of these modes simultaneously, so they're not necessarily exclusive. And certain of the Vinaya narratives I will share with you today display all the marks of good storytelling, they have developed characters, and so forth. But still, they describe a way of life or a monastic culture or particular situations that need not themselves be regarded as fabricated or purely imagined or discursively constructed. So I find La Riviere's approach particularly interesting for looking at Vinaya texts, actually exciting for looking at Vinaya texts through the lens of gender. If Vinaya texts for nuns are, at least in some measure, records of custom, then there are two very interesting entailments from that. First, while the literariness of Vinaya narratives must be attended to carefully, narratives about nuns can also be treated, at least to some degree, as historically descriptive of female monastic life during the period when they were compiled, though probably not necessarily descriptive of the very earliest community surrounding the Buddha. And I think this is something interesting. What I think is even more interesting is that La Riviere's idea of these types of texts as being records of custom also allow us to see that while Bhikshuni Vinayas were probably authored, male-authored, right, in a technical sense, they perhaps can also be interpreted as records of female agency. In other words, records of the ways in which women actually practice monasticism in ancient India. This is very exciting because it means that Vinaya texts may be evidence not only of what men thought about women in ancient Buddhist India, but also of what women themselves were doing and thinking. Okay, so what we're going to do from here forward is read a few of these texts with you, mostly from the Malok Bhikshuni Vinaya, but a few from the Mula Savastivada Vinaya. Using this interpretive approach, we're going to kind of give it a try and see where we get. Okay, so this is the first text. This is a text from the MSV. It's from the Uttara Granta portion of the MSV, which hasn't been studied very much. And this is not one that I actually have looked at all that closely, but studied closely myself, but Chopin has looked at this and similar related texts very closely and discusses it in his article, Separate but Equal Property Rights and Legal Independence of Buddhist Nuns and Monks in Early North India. And this is an article from 2008. So in it, Chopin draws on several gendered but complementary and parallel Uttara Granta texts to demonstrate the financial independence of nuns. So what is on the slide here is an excerpt from a text describing a situation in which a nun has died and her belongings have been kept by a monk for safekeeping. Her fellow nuns come to ask for her belongings, and there's a conflict over who should have her belongings, the nuns or the monks who had saved them for her after she died. And then what we have here is the resolution, which was put forward by the Buddha. So the Buddha ordains that what had belonged to the nun belongs to the nun's sangha. even though they've been held in safekeeping of and in the vihara of her Dharma brothers. Okay, so let's look at the text. It says, when a certain nun died in travesty, her bowl and robes had been left with a monk. After the nuns had cremated her corpse, they assembled at the retreat house of the nuns, and when they looked for the bowls and robes, when they did not find them, after they came to know that they were with a monk named so-and-so in a vihara, they went to the vihara, and after venerating the feet of the monks, take note of that detail, they said, noble sirs, the nun named so-and-so has died, and since her bowl and robes are here, we are seeking them, you must return them. Blessed One said, if the bowl and robes are nuns, they are the nuns. This is the resolution. And since the nuns are the owners, monks must not keep them. Okay. So what Chopin discusses in his article is that there's a similar and parallel text regarding the belongings of a dead monk, which came to be held by a nun, but are ultimately returned to the monk sangha. And Chopin notes the legal equality of nuns to monks in these texts. But he also notes their ritual inequality, right, as per the first Guru Dharma, requiring them to venerate the feet of the monks when entering their vihara, okay, but not vice versa. So in the parallel text, the monks do not venerate the feet of the nuns, obviously. But what Chopin emphasizes is the ritual subordination of nuns to monks does not supervene, does not sort of turn over the legislation of their financial equality and independence. And Chopin has worked on other examples of nuns' financial independence in others of his articles. Okay, so just to add to the picture, just to flesh out the picture, I want to show you another text. This is a section from the Malok Bhikshuni Vinaya discussion of Guru Dharma 1, which is the one which ordains that that even a nun who has been ordained 100 years must venerate the feet of a monk even if he has been ordained for only one day or on that day. Okay, so this is a little section from the Malok Bhikshuni Vinaya's discussion of the Guru Dharma 1. And it's about what to do about older nuns who physically have trouble venerating the feet of monks. Okay, so if we look at the text, it says, when the monks enter the residence of the nuns, by all the nuns, whether old, young, or in the middle, to all of the monks, whether old, young, or in the middle, a respectful gesture should be made, raising their cupped hands in salutation. In the case of a nun who was old, weak, and sick, she should honor with her head the feet of whomever she is able, having made cupped hands at the level of her head, she should honor the remaining. She should say, I honor the feet of all the noble ones. So I find this to be a vivid text that gives you a sense of the rather dramatic, I would say, indignities that inevitably follow from this rule. Okay, but as Chopin points out, the foundational ethical ideal, which encodes gender hierarchy enshrined in Guru Dharma 1, however imperfectly or perfectly it was actually practiced, did not contravene the legal and financial independence of the nuns' community from the monks' community. So you can have both simultaneously. You can have legal equality or financial equality and ritual inequality. So in looking at Chopin's text on recovering the property of a deceased nun, we have, at least according to me, three modes available to us for interpreting this text. And I'll show you the modes again in case you have forgotten them. So which one apply? Which do we use here? How should we read this text? And if we were sitting in a physical classroom together, I probably would throw this out to you and have you play around with it, see what you thought. It's a little bit awkward on this online kind of medium. perhaps you can chime in the chat box if you like. So I would read Chopin's text, and we can go to the text again. I would read Chopin's text in modes 2 and 3. So as a record of custom and as a normative statement about monastic ethical ideals. The ritual priority of monks to nuns that is architectural to Indian monasticism and is upheld here. But with that, I would argue that we also see here a record of customary institutional life, a life that allowed and even protected the independence and legal rights of women. And in fact, this reading is not very different from the reading that Chopin gives to this text. Okay, so that's the first text. Here's the second text I'd like to look at together. I'm calling it Behaving Like a Wife. So this text is from the Vibhanga section of the Maluk Bhikshuni Vinaya. It's an excerpt from a narrative about an older couple, known here as Gartodara's mother and Gartodara's father, and they've gone forth into homelessness together. Okay, so let's take a look at the text. So Gartodara, Gartodara's mother, and Gartodara's father wandered forth from householdership into homelessness. Gartodara's father was eating. Fanning him, Gartodara's mother stood opposite and held his water pot. He prattled on about various events of the past that were unpleasant to her. She jammed the water pot onto his head, and then she hit him about the head with the fan handle. "You ignorant, useless, spiteful old man," she said. "You are speaking of things that should not be mentioned." She was seen by the nuns. The nuns briefed Mahaprajapati Gautami on the matter. Mahaprajapati Gautami told the Lord. The Lord said, "You have done ill, mother of Gartodara. This is not the teaching. This is not the discipline. You stand by this monk with water and fan while he eats. It is not suitable to stand by with fan and water in this way." So, interesting text. During a meal, the former husband and wife have started to bicker, and Gartodara's mother grows angry and physically abuses her ex-husband, smacking him with the fan, overturning the pot of water on his head. When the situation is brought to the attention of the Buddha, however, his ruling actually has nothing to do with a nun abusing a monk. Rather, he rules that a single nun should not stand by a single monk, fanning him and holding the water pot while he eats. So the casuistry, the adjustments, accommodations, which I've not included here, specifies that it's okay for a nun to fan and pour water for a group of monks or for a monk who is her father or her brother. Okay, so I've written elsewhere about how this text addresses in interesting ways the what I call intersectional identity of Buddhist nuns who must conform to Buddhist discipline while also being responsive to general customs and expectations for women. Here, and I mean by responsive, I don't mean necessarily responsive and always in a positive way, but sometimes they may have to deliberately go against what's expected to them sort of out on the street as women. Here, a nun is behaving a bit too much like a wife, serving her husband at mealtime. This is apparently deemed unacceptable, although the text doesn't explicitly put it that way, right? But I think it implies it, that what is virtuous for a wife is not the same thing as what is virtuous for a Buddhist nun. Still, the rule promulgated does not completely disrupt a common image of female virtue, which includes serving men, as a nun may serve a group of monks or a monk who is a brother or a father. Rather, it disrupts a portion of that female norm, the portion that says that such mealtime service is appropriate for wives. So how do we read this text? Is this text the, quote, literary product of a certain gendered worldview? Is it a normative statement of an ethical ideal or ritual practice? Is it a record of custom? How do we read it? I would read this as literary and normative, but not necessarily as a record of monastic custom. It seems to me that here we have a well-developed character, a funny and engaging story with a well-developed narrative, which is a funny and engaging story with a well-drawn character, which is Gartodara's mother. As such, it ought to be read as a literary text that reflects a certain gendered worldview. But it seems to me that this text is also normative. It is asserting an important and central ethical principle regarding the status of nuns. That is that they are by definition not wives. I'm not sure there is a strong reason to read the text as a record of custom for nuns. I'm not sure it's we can justify drawing from this the conclusion that it was the custom for nuns to stand by fanning monks and serving water for them. But it might actually make some sense to argue that this text is a record of non-monastic custom, the custom of for householders, wives, to wait upon their husbands in a way, in this way, in the context of lay life. And so in this sense, perhaps we could take it as a record of lay custom, a particular lay custom that had a way of bleeding into monastic life. Okay. On to the next text that I have today for you. So this is a text from the Prakirnika or miscellaneous section of the Mahalok Bhikshuni Vinaya. It's about Sudina, who goes forth into homelessness after her husband dies. At the beginning of the story, Sudina has already been ordained as a nun, but she is fleeing from her brother-in-law, who is claiming levirate rights over her. He wants to marry her. She is physically in danger and takes refuge in the home of a laywoman. So this is where we enter the story. Okay, so she's in the home of the laywoman and she's being pursued. They attached anklets, affixed earrings, put on bracelets, ornamented Sudina, draped her with red garments, concealed her under a veil, and surrounded her by four or five female attendants. That man, the former husband's brother, standing in the doorway, watched them, thinking, "When she comes out, I will grab her." When he saw her coming out, he thought, "She must be a housewife surrounded by servants. That one is no nun." Now, when that nun reached her place of refuge, she was seen by the other nuns. They said, "Arya, that Sudina has run away from the nunnery." Sudina said, "I have not run away. It is just that my husband's brother wishes to take me away. Fearful of him and desiring protection, I dressed in this way." Okay. So the laywoman dresses her as an upper-class woman and surrounds her with servants in order to disguise her true identity. In this way, she reaches her nunnery safely. The other nuns question her actions, thinking she has transgressed her vows and run away from the monastery or the nunnery. I have not given it here, but the Buddha rules that while violating the codes of deportment is not appropriate, it is not a major offense if undertaken for reasons of self-protection. Okay, so this text speaks to the apparent physical and social vulnerability of female monastics in ancient India, and the many Vinaya stories about nuns suffering rape provide further indication of their vulnerability, their physical vulnerability as a group. Okay, so this is the first of three stories which I actually want to read together as a group. Okay, so hold on to that one, and we'll look at the next one. So this is a text from the Prakirnika section, again, of the Mahalok Bhikshuni Vinaya. And I'm going to read the text first. So the Lord was staying at Travesti. The nun, Stula Nanda, was on begging grounds. She approached the great and superior household for alms. There, a stillborn male child had been born to a woman. She said to her, "Noble lady, take this child away. Please take it, noble lady. I will give you something." "I will not take this away," said the nun. "I will give you anything and everything," the woman pleaded. Greedy, Stulananda replied, "Put it in this bowl." After covering it, the bowl, she left. Okay, so here the nun Stulananda is asked by a distraught laywoman to carry away her stillborn baby's body. Although the story does not say so explicitly, the circumstance seems to indicate that she does not wish to inform her family members about the death of her baby. Stulananda does carry the child's body away, concealing it in her begging bowl. Curiously, the rule that follows this story concerns regulations governing the covering and uncovering of nuns' begging bowls, but does not say anything about the carrying away of stillborn fetuses. The Chulavaga version, though, does actually prohibit the carrying away of fetuses in nuns' begging bowl. So this is one of two texts in the Malok Bhikshuni Vinaya that speak of clandestine interactions between nuns and laywomen around matters having to do with miscarriage, or two that I've found so far, around matters having to do with miscarriage and abortion. The other one has to do with guidelines for building nunnery latrines, but I'm not going to go into that story. They'll have to wait for another day. Okay, so that's the second text in this group of three that I want to discuss together. And so let's now look at the next one that I call Practicing the Medical Arts. Okay, so this text, which is, again, from the Malok Bhikshuni Vinaya, and is regarding another example of nuns and laywomen working together, independently of men, to take care of health-related problems. This text tells the story of Chandramata, who, with the help of various upper-class and noble ladies, I think that is implied by the fact that it says that she was accepted into the inner household of the king, so I think that would refer to, you know, the women's quarters. So they worked together to establish a clinic for women. So let's read the text, or the portion that I've given you. A nun, mother of Chandika, was accepted in the inner household of the king. She was skillful with root medicines, leaf medicines, and fruit medicines. With the king's relatives, the minister's relatives, the merchants' families, and other excellent families, she established a hostel for women. She cured fainting fits. She offered medical treatments such as black ointment, other ointments, emetics, purgatives, sweat treatments, nasal treatments, and bloodletting. Before she left, she received soft food and hard food. Okay. So eventually, Chandramata is reported for these activities to the Buddha by other nuns, who say that she is behaving as a doctor, as a healer, and not as a nun. And he rules that it is not suitable for nuns to practice medicine. Okay, so that's the last of the three texts I want to take as a cluster. All three of these texts are similar in that they narrate the collaboration of nuns and laywomen regarding problems that are particular to women, physical vulnerability to assault, pressure surrounding a wife's fertility, and private health concerns. Applying our interpretive framework, how should we view this cluster of texts? Well, first of all, I would say that all three are richly evocative examples of Vinaya storytelling. There is no better character, for instance, than Stulananda, who was always brassy, loudmouth, self-serving, also, though, full of confidence, and it would seem something of a proto-feminist. Sudina's story is rather dramatic. One imagines her slipping in and out of doorways, pursued by the brother-in-law bent on asserting his sexual rights over her, and later hurrying through the dark streets disguised as an ornamented and veiled upper-class lady. Chandramata's story also provides an evocative glimpse into the life of the inner household of the king. I think in this way, we could say that all three offer literary expressions of a gendered Buddhist worldview. But none of the three seems closely connected to me to core Buddhist ethical norms or foundational monastic ritual forms, except maybe the Chandramata story, which is related to the monastic prohibition on practicing and teaching deviant, so-called deviant lore. Okay, so definitely we should read these texts from a literary point of view. Perhaps we don't need to focus so much on them as normative expressions. But are these Vinaya stories records of custom? In order to answer this question fully, I believe that we have to stretch Le Revere's category a bit. So I'm not sure that I would want to argue that these stories are a record of customs of female monastic life in their particulars, with the possible exception of the Tendagamata story. I would argue, however, that taken together, they may well illustrate a general feature of female monastic life, that is, a close and cooperative relationship with female lay supporters. In this sense, these stories can be taken as records of custom. So what I would like to say is that it was customary for nuns to rely upon, cooperate, and work closely with lay women, and vice versa, in negotiating a world in which men as a group enjoyed unquestioned authority and had greater access to resources than women did. Okay, two more. I have two more for you. Both of them concern the female body and in particular menstruation, something which obviously did not concern the male Sangha, at least in terms of their own community life. Okay. So this is a text from the Bhikshuni Vibhanga section of the MSV regarding methods for managing monthly menstrual flow. Okay. This is just a little section of the text. It says, for women, because of the degenerative force of previous karma, every month blood trickles out. Because of this, the Lord told nuns to wear a special garment for concealing the menstrual flow. At the time, he said to, quote, keep a special garment. The Lord knew it was sure to fall if a nun put it on and walked. So at the same time, he instructed them to, quote, keep a special garment. He also said to, quote, attach it with a string. Okay. So very practical instructions for managing menstrual mess. And there's a somewhat similar text, not identical, but somewhat similar text allowing nuns to use a cloth shaped like an axle pin to prevent the free flow of menstrual blood, which is found in the Malok Bhikshuni Vinaya, but I didn't give it to you here. Okay, so here's and we're going to look at these two menstrual texts together. Here's the next one. This is from back to the Malok Bhikshuni Vinaya from the Bhikkhunika section. And this is actually the first of a series of texts that are all in a row, which regulate where the nuns should launder their menstrual cloths. Okay, so this is what the text says. The Lord was staying at Travesti. At that time, the nuns were washing their menstrual cloths in the bathing place for women. The women looked upon them with contempt, saying, this entire place has been made impure by their blood. The nuns briefed Mahaprajapati Gautami on the matter. Mahaprajapati Gautami told the Lord, the Lord said, it is not suitable to wash menstrual cloths in the women's washing place. A nun who washes her menstrual cloth in the women's washing place transgresses against monastic discipline. This is said regarding the women's washing place. Okay, so two things to notice about these texts. First, they demonstrate a sensitivity to the purity concerns of the general population, or especially the second one does. And second, there is a nominal linking of female bleeding with inferior karma. Well, and that is especially in the first text. So, however, as I've written about elsewhere, neither of these texts, and Vinaya Law in general, does not seriously treat menstrual blood as anything other than a hygienic problem for nuns. So there is no sort of ritual period of isolation from male monastics or lay people, no ritual bathing to be done or anything of the kind. Okay, so how do we interpret these texts? I would like to say, what can we learn from them? The first of these two texts has strong narrative elements. I didn't provide the full story for you, but Stulananda is central in that text, and her kind of salty way of speaking ends up offending the townspeople. Who rebel against the Buddha's Stulananda also ends up rebelling against the Buddha's menstrual law. So she refuses to wear her cloth and string. So it does have a strong narrative element. And I think that most Buddhist narratives that involve Stulananda, and there are many, do reflect a gendered worldview. Interestingly, it's a worldview that acknowledges but is simultaneously ambivalent about the agency of women, right? So Stulananda is a pretty obnoxious character, but she also is a very strong character. And we're going to hear a good bit more about Stulananda from my colleague Reiko Onuma in a few weeks. I'm excited about that. Okay, the second of the two texts is not really a story per se, so I don't think that the narrative element is strong there. In neither case are the rules propagated closely linked to Buddhist norms or foundational monastic rituals. So I don't really think either can be said to be expressing some kind of normative ethical principle. For me, these two texts are really best interpreted as records of custom. In the first, we have a record of what nuns wore in order to manage their monthly bleeding. In the second, we have a record of conflicts surrounding the management of female blood in public and of the monastic community's dealing response to that conflict, pragmatic response to that conflict. Moreover, what we have here is a particularly clear-cut case of the lived practices of the ancient monastic community that are then formulated, rationalized, and made to fit into the Buddhist monastic community's narrative about itself. I don't really believe that the mechanics of menstrual hygiene for nuns are part of the core Buddhist ethical vision for a monastic community, nor do I believe that they are a product of the MSV's fertile literary imagination. Rather, to my mind, these rules must be records of local female custom rationalized according to the Buddhist idiom, the Vinaya idiom. Although menstrual hygiene or laundry conflicts may not in and of themselves be fascinating subjects to everyone, I find them kind of interesting, but what is quite fascinating, I think, for everyone, or should be fascinating for everyone, is the fact that the customs recorded here are likely to have been promulgated by nuns, not authored as law and passed down by monks. So I think in these two little texts, we're coming pretty close to female monastic agency. Okay, so in conclusion, what we have learned about the historical ancient nuns community, what have we learned about the historical ancient nuns community, about monastic ethics, and about the gendered worldview from these passages? Now, we already know that monastic institutional structure encodes a strict gender hierarchy in which women are placed below men, so that's nothing new. But I do agree with Chopin that these texts demonstrate that the nun sangha was also an environment in which women were allowed to achieve some legal and financial, and I would add social, independence. In fact, by my reading these texts that show that nuns were agents of their own lives to a remarkable extent, I think they can be read as records of the way nuns worked to solve the problems they faced as female monastics in a social environment that did not always support them, or that expected certain things of women that were not expected of men. Although the traditions of monasticism handed down by their male teachers may have provided monastic women with normative guidelines, it's likely that the women who worked out the practical dimensions of living as nuns in a world that very much preferred them to live as wives and mothers, it's likely that it was women who worked out those practical dimensions, the nuns themselves, in other words. I believe that if we read Vinaya texts in a complex way that is sensitive to their various modalities, it becomes possible to detect the ancient nuns' contributions to the construction of the monastic life represented there. So it becomes possible to glimpse female agency in these texts. And that's all I have for today. Thank you very much. So I'm happy to maybe answer some questions if you have any. You're welcome. Or if not, we certainly can discuss them in the forum as well. So Biko Analio is saying that regarding the historical against the literal reading, he'd like to mention that he's not sure if the fact that a certain misconduct is reported in the Vinaya means that something of that type must have happened. Right. Yes, I think you're right, and I think I would stick here to my feeling that it's important to read Vinaya texts flexibly, right? You don't need to read them always through one interpretive lens, and I think that sometimes perhaps a misconduct reported in the Vinaya and then prescribed may be evidence that people were doing it, but in other cases, certainly not. So, for instance, the idea of nuns running brothels, right, may not be something we can argue that they actually did or want to argue that they actually did. Waiting for questions, if there are any. I don't know if I see it says Sabine Schütz gibt ein. I don't know if that means that someone's typing a question.
It means that she's typing a question, yes.
Okay. So Sabina's asking, could it also be that different passages could be read in different ways, that sometimes they depict historical reality, but others may reflect what was considered desirable? Yeah, absolutely. And that's sort of what I was trying to get at when I was talking about the difference between a normative reading and an historical reading. So some texts may depict something which was considered desirable or ideal and be prescribing that and recommending it and imagining it, while others may be actually depicting something that monks and nuns are actually doing rather than an ideal behavior that's being imagined and recommended. I think that it's impossible to really get a good sense of what's going on in these texts if we only take a normative approach or only take an historical approach. I think we have to be very sensitive to the kind of texture of the text. I hope that answers your question. So Biko Analio is saying that I wonder if the placing of the 8 Guru Dharma at the outset of the Mahasankhika Lokottaravada Bhikshuni Vinaya has some special significance in terms of placing additional importance on the 8 Guru Dharmas. That would be in line with what I believe to be the general tendency of investing those 8 with increasing importance as time goes by. That's really interesting. Yeah. That's really interesting. I wonder about that as well. And again, I think that it's hard to get at the answer to that without a better sense of the dating of the text, and I totally sidestep that issue because I really am not in a position to argue for a date for this text. Hopefully I will be at some point, but not at the moment. And then Bhikkhuni Dhamma Dina is saying that Guru Dharma 4 in the Mahasanghika Lokottaravadin Vinaya seems to reflect Brahmanical hierarchies in the duties with regard to hospitality, which entailed food offering, first to be served in the highest in hierarchy, the Brahmins. Yeah, that's an interesting point. I think it is really one of the things that and this relates to the fact that these texts are Sanskrit. I think that one of the things that's really interesting about the Mahasanghika Lokottaravada Vinaya is that I feel that there's a lot of interaction with Brahmin practices that are evidenced in the text. And I would like to look into that more. Although I also think, I guess I would also say that I'm not sure that a food hierarchy like that is necessarily Brahmanic or exclusively Brahmanic. I think that it could just be a sort of wider, more general practice in the social life of ancient North India. And then we have Hongyan Chi, Venerable Hongyan Chi, saying, I can attest in the four-part Bhikshuni Pratimoksha and the Dharmaguptaka, the placement of the Guru Dharmas are at the end of a separate section, like in Afterthought. Yes, thank you for that. Okay, so Vikram Dinalankara is saying, while some practices may have originated in a Brahmanic cultural setting, eventually they may have become adopted by Buddhists that by the time the rule was laid down, it was considered a normal Buddhist practice. Right. Yeah, exactly. And I wonder also about making a firm distinction between Buddhist practice and Brahmanic practice, as if the two communities were so very separate in their way of life. So obviously Buddhist monasticism is a very distinct way of life, but when we're talking about Buddhist lay people, would their way of life been so radically different from their Brahmin neighbors? Clearly there would have been distinctions in terms of religious ritual life, but things like hierarchies of food, serving food, things like that, I wonder if they really would have been so different. And then Venerable Hongyan Chi is saying, adding, also the tone of these written in the Chinese in that same four-part Bhikshuni Pratimoksha are written as curses, very ugly word choices. Yours are written so nicely. I'm sorry, the tone of which? I think I'll wait for Venerable to respond so I can follow up on her. The Guru Dharmas are written as curses with horrible pronouncements. I see. I see. Well, I'd like to learn more about that. That's interesting. Thank you. Okay, Sophie Florence says, do you think that in the instances you discussed related to the management of nuns' menstrual cycles, that this demonstrates the nuns were responsible for authoring some sections of Vinaya? Or is this simply a record of their practices by males who compiled the texts? I wonder about that. I do wonder. I don't have an answer one way or the other, but I think that we're supposed to think that these texts are entirely male authored and that women weren't writing, they weren't composing texts, and that many nuns would have been possibly illiterate, that women just simply didn't have access to language and writing in this way or developing these traditions orally as well. They weren't in the position of being teachers. I mean, I think that we're supposed to think this, but I do question, I do wonder. Of course, there are many examples of women in very traditional ancient cultures being literate and being authors and being teachers. So I don't have a firm answer, Sophie, to your question, but I think there is some, it's open to question. But I would say at the very least that I think that the practices themselves were non-authored. So I think that they were working out how to manage these things like menstruation in the context of their monastic discipline, right? So they had agency. They were working out those practices. They weren't I don't believe they were waiting for the male community to tell them how to do it, although it sort of comes across that way in the text. But that's an example of what La Riviere is talking about, of reconciling custom, reconciling what people are actually doing to the kind of normative and the narrative idiom of the text. And I don't know if Biko Analio, if you have something to add. And here you are. I agree with your reflection that the nuns would have had some agency in the formation of the Vinaya text dealing with their behavior. The emphasis given to monks in the formation of rules for nuns, in fact, differs among the different Vinayas. Interesting. That's another I would like to hear more about how you think it differs. So Bhikkhu Analio has written, I mean that in some Vinayas, Mahavajapati directly informs the Buddha of a problem, and others she tells the monks and they tell the Buddha. Yes, exactly, right. So that's the case. It's the case that the Mahavajapati interacts directly with the Buddha in the Mahasamgika Lokottaravadin tradition. Is that the case in other traditions? I didn't realize that happened in any of the other traditions. I know it doesn't in the MSP and the Pali. And then Bhikkhu Analio says, such variations in my mind reflect choices of the narrator and do not reflect the situation on the ground. Such variations in my mind reflect choices. Oh, same thing twice. Yes. Yes, yes, yes. I mean, again, exactly. So we need to be careful about the tenor, the tone, the texture of the text. And we make mistakes in changing how we interpret each passage, but I don't think there's any way around it. I think we need to use good judgment and sensitive reading practices and not read every section through the same interpretive lens. And then Bhikkhu Analio says, in some Vinayas, in Mahavajapati, Gautami has very few interactions with the Buddha, i.e. the Theravada Buddha. Yes. And the MSV as well. And Bhikkhu Analio says that he thinks that my suggestion about agency of nuns makes a lot of sense. Glad you agree. Bhikkhu Daman Dina says, I agree with Venerable Anaglio, however, that such a narrative choice was conceivable as evidence in itself of what tradition may have considered at least possible. Yes, and I agree with that as well. Even something which was not actually happening, the fact that people could imagine it is extremely significant. So in England and America, women had to imagine having the vote, right, before it actually was put into law. And there was a long period of time between the imagining and the legal change, just as an example. Venerable Hong Yang Shi says, regarding the issue of menstruation, I think it must be setting a standard rather than the mundane issue of the cycles because of cultural and women's issue not being in the forefront of discussion. I mean, in setting the type of cloth and string. Huh. So I guess you're saying that you would see this more as setting a standard of behavior rather than being a description of what people were already doing. Oh, setting the type of cloth and string, right. Yes, exactly. And that's part of my point is it's so striking, right, that in these texts we have the Buddha sort of giving hygienic advice to the vinyas to the nuns about how they're going to manage their menstrual cycles. It's quite striking, right? So I think that it's better read as a record of custom. Not just of custom, but of women's necessity being met by prospective donations of cloth and material. Oh, yes. So that would be a reason why that these customs would have been brought, or these practices would have been brought into the text itself and textualized, made formal in that way in order to kind of lay the groundwork for eliciting donations of cloth and material. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you so much. That's so interesting. And then Bhikkhuni Dhammadina says, it is still quite forward-thinking since menstruating women could not join any Brahminical ritual. Bhikkhunis are not prohibited from teaching or participating in legal acts of the Sangha when menstruating. Yes, exactly. And this is some of the things that I talk about in my, I have an article forthcoming in the Journal of the American Academy of Religion that's about female impurity in Indian Buddhism. And one of the points I make is how actually remarkably unritualized female blood is in Vinaya texts, that there's a lot of kind of legal ritual space around blood. There is isn't a lot of restriction on women. And this is in contrast to some of the talk about blood you find in other types of Buddhist texts. And then Sophie Florence asks, do you think speaking about it so openly could be a stab at brahminical purity issues surrounding menstrual blood? I actually don't really think so. First of all, because the Vinaya texts would not have, I doubt that Brahmins would have had much use for them. They wouldn't have been very, they wouldn't have been reading them or hearing about them too much, I don't think. But, you know, I suppose it could have been a kind of internal boundary maintenance, saying that, well, we talk about blood openly and we don't ritually restrict women around blood, but the Brahmins do. But I don't actually read it that way, because I think there's plenty of talk of blood pollution and what I call blood pollution, or sort of the ritual, the moral issues with the female body and with the blood that comes out of the female body and the female reproductive organs. There's plenty of kind of very negative talk about that in other types of Buddhist literature. It's just not in the Vinaya. So I actually don't think that, I think that the Buddhists had their own way of talking about female impurity, a very distinctive way. They just didn't, it just wasn't relevant in terms of the nuns' community and in terms of monastic discipline, which I agree with Bhikkhuni Dhammadina is quite forward-thinking. And then Bhikkhuni Dhammadina says, what Venerable Hongyang suggests makes a lot of sense, since shape and measurements of allowable robes, or temporarily allowable robes, as in this case, are regulated by the Vinaya. One could not use any odd piece of cloth without determining it for use. Yes. Yeah, I really appreciate that point. I'm so glad that you brought that up. Thank you so much for that. So maybe it seems like there aren't any more questions. Oh. Thank you all for such a great conversation. And thank you for asking me to do it. I really enjoyed it.
I switched off the recording now.